Welcome to the AquariumMax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 63, recorded May 24th, 2011.
All right, welcome everyone. We hope that you notice the microphone today. It sounds different than it did last week or the week before.
Switched back.
We switched back to our cheap microphone, which
apparently works better.
Yeah. We had some comments about the microphone, which we very much appreciate because it helped us know that
we
can take that other microphone back and save some money.
Yeah.
Someday we'll spring for a really expensive one, but apparently the cheap ones.
This is not that day.
No, this is not that day. The cheap ones are better than the mid-range ones that we have tried. So we'll just go back to this. In fact, Dave D., who has contributed several times, says he enjoys the podcast, but he would like to cast his vote for the older microphone because the new one is tinny in sound. He didn't even think about the sound quality before the new mic, but he had to with the newer mic. So we're going back to the old one so he doesn't have to worry about it. It's always a good sign if you don't have to think about the sound quality because
yes.
It's good enough that you don't
notice
you're not
it.
Bothered by it. Clint says he's a regular listener on iTunes, too. But the mic sounds like two walkie-talkies made of cans and a string strung between them. Something like that.
And while those are fun on Little Rascals episodes, that's not what we want to sound like.
That's not what we want to sound like.
Thank you, gentlemen, for chiming in.
Yes, both to Dave D. and to Clint, we're glad you enjoy the podcast. And we hope that this constitutes an auditory improvement.
Now you can enjoy them even more.
Yeah, there we go. All right.
Andreka. Hi, Andreka. She sent in a comment this week, too.
Yeah, she
said...
It was
kind of a nice comment,
it was.
Actually. So
we liked it.
Forgive us for telling it to you. Hopefully we're not tooting our own horn.
Oh, no.
She's
no.
tooting it for us.
She just mentioned... She thought we were like the David Letterman show of the fish world. I think it's because we do top 10 lists sometimes. That was cool. I liked that. That was funny. So, thank you, Andreka, also.
Okay, let's move on to Jeff's question about red-eyed, red-tailed puffers.
Okay.
Sounds like a song, you know, red-eyed, red-tailed puffers, are they aggressive?
That kind of works.
Okay,
yeah,
sorry.
I like that. No, that was good. You should keep that one. Should write it down.
Yeah, it'll be a number one.
Well, he was wondering if they're aggressive with guppies. Now, I have limited experience with puffers. With dwarf puffers... which are actually fairly closely related to the red-eyed, red-tailed puffers. I have had fairly extensive experience, several years. And I've kept them with guppies. And I can't quite say that it's the best thing to do. I've had times when it works fine and times when it doesn't. I think it...
Does it just depend on hiding places?
I think it depends on the hiding places. I think it depends on the individual temperament of the puffer. I think it... depends on how well you're feeding the puffer and what type of food it's eating, so on. Their aggression is usually minimized as long as there are snails and things like that that they can take their aggressions out on. But if there aren't as many snails, then the guppies can sometimes be targets. Now, dwarf puffers are not the exact same species as red-eyed, red-tailed puffers. And so I can't really say what they might do. But if they're doing fine with your guppies... and Jeff mentions that they seem to be doing fine with his guppies right now, then it's probably okay for now.
Just keep an eye on them.
Keep the puffers well fed. And at the first sign of aggression, you may just have to be prepared to redo things. When I had dwarf puffers, I noticed that I often had to do that myself. Just kind of keep an eye on what they were doing and change things around a lot. So hopefully, I know that wasn't extremely helpful, but maybe it gave you some idea just to be watchful about it, because I don't really think you can trust puffers as far as anything. They're difficult to trust.
They're a little naughty sometimes. Okay, we have another international message tonight, which is pretty cool.
Yeah,
and it's from a youngster.
All the way in?
Australia!
Yeah, so Jackson, thank you for contributing all the way from Australia. That's pretty cool. He has a question about a couple of things about, well, he has a tank that he's set up that he's got the choice of doing ghost shrimp or cherry shrimp, and he wants to know whether there's really a big difference between ghost shrimp or fairy shrimp, because...
Glass shrimps.
Ghost shrimp, glass shrimp, it's actually the term, it can be used interchangeably. We'll talk about the differences there. But, yeah, he did use the word glass shrimp, so thank you for reminding me about that. And he has a tank that is about, or he's going to get a tank, which is about 100 to 150 liters.
So what does that translate to in gallons?
Well, 110 liters is about 30 gallons, so... 30 American gallons. So okay. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 gallons, a little bit more, a little bit less, depending on which size he actually goes for. And he wanted to know what he should do with it about the stocking. One of his questions, it says his local fish shop has two different types of shrimps, glass shrimps and cherry shrimps. The glass shrimps are sold as feeders, and they cost about $6 for 10 of them. And the cherry shrimps are $2.75 each.
So the glass shrimps are considerably more economical.
Yeah.
Especially if you're 13.
Right. And he's wondering why the cherry shrimp is so expensive. Is there a reason for that? And does it really matter which one he gets, which type of shrimp he gets? So let's talk about that for a moment. Well, one, let's give you sort of a quick profile on glass shrimps. Well, glass shrimps is really a catch-all term for several species of transparent shrimp. That's why they call them glass shrimp. They're also known as ghost shrimp. The names are interchangeable because there are several different species and even probably genera, which is the plural of genus, of course, around, that just happen to share this transparency. And they're often found in coastal areas, in brackish water, sometimes in salt, sometimes in fresh. They tend to be pretty forgiving in terms of salinity of water. And so you can buy them and put them in a freshwater tank, and they can live quite well there, and they can often do well in a saltwater tank, at least for quite a while. So they make good feeders in that sense, that they can be fed to saltwater organisms as well as freshwater organisms. They are omnivorous, so they'll nibble on a bit of algae, they'll eat flake food, they'll eat more or less anything that they can get their little chelipeds on. And they're interesting creatures. They can be kept in aquaria and you know, make interesting aquarium inhabitants. Generally, they do quite well. Now, they're cheap partly because it's really easy to collect them.
Do they collect them or do they breed them?
I think they're usually collected. There are probably some people around there breeding them.
Where do they collect them? I mean, where do you find them in the wild?
Coastal marshes and so on. All over the world, there are many different places, at least. I don't know everywhere, but many different places in the world where you can find shrimp of that type. In general, some sort of transparent little shrimp. They can be bred in captivity. I've bred them myself. They're not particularly easy to breed in large quantities. Generally, when I did it, I'd put several in a well-planted tank with low water currents, and occasionally I'd get planktonic larvae, just like an Opiula shrimp, that float in the water column, head down, tail up, for a couple of weeks, and then they finally metamorphose into the adult form.
So if you have them in with fish, those will probably get eaten.
Yeah, yeah. And I've never had larvae show up in a tank with fish, at least not that survived. But I have had them in tanks by themselves, where they've survived, but not in large quantities. Just a few of them appeared. I think the adults actually will prey on them too if they catch them, so it makes it a little tough. Glass shrimps are a little bit more aggressive than some other shrimp, so they will occasionally take nips out of fish fins if they're really hungry and things like that. So that gives you an idea.
They're more aggressive than the cherry shrimp?
They are more aggressive than the cherry shrimp. They're also usually a bit larger. Cherry shrimp are more expensive partly because they're better at eating algae. Cherry shrimp are omnivorous as well, but they do a better job at clearing plants and glass of algae. They are also, they have the bright colors. You get the cherry red color.
Which is very pretty and striking.
Which is pretty and striking. You can also get Wild colored shrimp, which vary from sort of a greenish color to a grayish color to a slightly bluish color to a more transparent color, brownish, they vary quite a bit. So they're also easier to breed in terms of you'll get larger numbers of shrimp. You can keep, if you keep sherry shrimp together, they will breed. And the young shrimp, as soon as they hatch, are miniature replicas of the adults, which
so
do
they're
not...
they're not planktonic.
They're not planktonic, and so they're not quite as sensitive during that early period, and so you can easily breed them. Of course, if you're breeding them with fish, you're going to get fewer of them, but I've successfully bred them even with small fish like celestial pearl danios, neons, guppies. You'll still get them to breed. I even have some in this tank next to me with the neon dwarf rainbows that breed in there, not in great quantities. Certainly some of them get eaten.
Tank stock.
But the tank, has a certain number of cherry shrimp in there that do well.
It's okay, they run.
And they do, they breed in there. They're reproducing in a population. So it doesn't really matter in terms of, are you going to have fun having shrimp in your tank? Are they going to provide an interesting creature? Then you can get either one. If you want to try your hand at breeding, I recommend the cherry shrimp. If you want something a little more colorful, I recommend the cherry shrimp. If you don't really care about either of those things, then it doesn't matter which one you get. If you want them to work on reducing algae in your tank, both of them will eat some algae, but cherry shrimp are a little bit more effective at it. So
if that's going to be your entire algae crew is just the shrimp, then maybe the cherry shrimp would be better?
Yeah, although, and they won't clear a tank entirely of algae unless they're kept by themselves and you have other means of keeping the algae, you're growing a lot of plants in the tank and you're keeping the plants really healthy, then they'll do a pretty good job at, and they're in large enough numbers, they might keep the tank completely free of algae. But if you're not watching those things particularly carefully, they won't keep a tank just free of algae just by themselves.
What would you recommend that he put in there with the shrimp in addition for algae?
For algae?
For algae crew.
Well, for algae crew... I don't know.
Is that too big of a question for right now?
It might be too big of a question for now.
Maybe
but
we'll do that on a future podcast, huh?
Yeah, maybe we could do that. But in answer to your question, Jackson, there you go. Hopefully that helps you make a decision.
So if it's just a question of economics, you'll be okay with the glass shrimp.
Right. And now let's go into your next question. You were wondering about discus fish, saying that you've always loved them. Are they really as demanding as they say? Do I need anything in particular to keep these fish? Well, I have not kept discus myself, so I am hesitant to say too much about it because I haven't done it. I can say a few things. One is, if you have kept discus fish out there, listeners of Aquarimax, and you'd like to chime in on this one, please feel free. If you want to do a show on discus, that'd be great.
Oh, yeah.
It would.
Be good to have another interview.
But I'll tell you one thing. In a tank that small, you wouldn't be able to keep very many discus. And you might run the risk of them getting stunted. You do need to change a lot of water when you keep discus. And you need to keep the temperature quite warm.
How big do they get?
They get really big. Their bodies can get considerably larger than a CD.
Oh, wow.
Some of them can approach a plate, like a dinner plate size.
So,
including
the
fins and so on.
That size of a tank would be...
They can get close to that.
Kind of confining...
Yeah,
them.
Not a really big dinner plate, but they get bigger than a CD. Yeah. So, a 30-gallon tank would be a bit small, and you do need to change a lot of water very frequently. The water quality needs to be really high, the water temperature needs to be really warm, so you're limited in what tank mates you can keep with them. There are some, but think about that. If you ever want to breed them, you have to pay attention to water quality, not just water quality, but water parameters like pH and acidity. And there are different camps on how much you need to do that and so on. And there's a difference between raising a few discus just for pets and trying to breed them, and there's another difference between trying to breed discus and trying to breed show quality discus. And they're all of those are three different, completely different worlds from what I understand. But once again, I'm not an expert on discus, so sorry, but I can't say a whole lot more about
it.
It does
kind of sound like maybe they would be better suited to a larger tank, or maybe a later tank.
Yeah.
I'm interested, Jackson, is this your first tank? Or is this an additional tank? Let us know. I think that would be interesting.
Yeah, that's a good question. Oh, and another thing that I should mention is if you keep glass shrimps and cherry shrimps, or cherry shrimps with discus, you'll have happy discus.
And no shrimp.
Pretty soon. It's also true with a lot of other small creatures. People try to keep discus with very small tetras, and as the discus grow, the tetras disappear. So there you go. It's their natural food in the wild.
Is tetras?
One of them, yes.
Now, where are discus
angelfish
from
too?
In the wild?
Amazon basin area.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So they do like to eat wee tetras and so on.
I like a wee tetra.
Yes, they do. Okay, what's next? What have we got?
Next, oh, Jackson also, he sent us another email too when we asked for suggestions for Russ's 5-gallon tank.
Oh,
so
yes.
So he had a suggestion about that. So we'll just stay with Jackson for another minute here.
Yeah. He thought about guppies. He said he's got a tank of guppies. So I guess he did answer your question about...
He did.
He's got a tank of guppies. And I do like guppies a lot, and I do have another tank of guppies.
Actually, you've had those guppies since you were... Well, not these specific
but
individual
the
guppies.
Of these guppies.
This strain of guppy has been going since you were 15? 16?
13, I think.
13?
13, I think, maybe. Yeah.
A long time.
Pretty sure. So yeah, and guppies are interesting. I have a special place in my heart for guppies. And then another would be another betta. And I am considering that, because it's kind of sad to be without a betta. Bettas are just fun.
And they're nice in an office, you know, because his students come in, and a betta is an immediate
draw.
Eye catcher.
Yeah.
Oh, and it looks like our break is coming up, so we will be right back. This isn't a commercial, because it's not trying to sell you anything. It is, however, the part where we shamelessly encourage you to be a part of the Aquarimax audio show by calling and leaving a message any time of the day or night at 801-477-0629. If you don't want to actually talk, but you do have a comment or question, you can just send us an email to info@aquarimax.com. There. That wasn't so painful now, was it? Okay, we're back, and we're going to go to Brian's comment left on the Facebook about last week's podcast.
Yes. He wanted to mention, since he is a professional who works with spawning salmon and so on, hatcheries and things in various capacities working with salmon and so on.
Which is a very cool job.
As a biologist. Yeah, that is very cool. He wanted to comment on his experience with fish eggs and spawning in relation to our discussion last week. He said they spawn, when they do assisted spawning with salmon, they spawn them in a bucket, and they don't add water to the bucket because the water shortens the egg's fertilization window to about 30 seconds, which is what we were talking about. So, and this is interesting, he said, often, depending on the male-to-female ratio, the milk from several males will be added to the row from one female to aid in genetic diversity. So you get a whole bunch of half-siblings in there instead of
just one.
All full siblings, and that makes sense, a good way to do that. And he said, once the eggs are hardened in water, they are very robust, and they can be exposed to air for surprisingly long periods of time and are able to survive being dropped or bounced on the ground.
Wow.
So there you go. Apparently something about being exposed to the water hardens the membrane around them, and that may be...
Yeah, 30 seconds is not a very long time.
No, that may be related to what inhibits their fertilization once that happens. So, yeah, there you go. A little bit more about that one.
That's very interesting to know.
Yeah. And let's see. We had some other comments. Jaden is... mentioning that he's happy that we're that he's not fearing anymore that we're going to stop doing our podcasts.
That's good.
Jackson asked,
is this the same Jackson from Australia?
Yes, it is. Uh-huh. Okay. He's asking what inspired us to make the podcast, and we basically said that it's because we were culturing the live food, and we were providing information on that, and it sort of blossomed.
We were selling the live food cultures and made it basically so people would have instructions on what to do when they got their worm cultures.
Yep, and it just grew from there. So there you go.
Mm-hmm.
And what have we got next?
Mick.
And
question from Mick.
And where's Mick from?
Mick,
I think Mick is from...
I have to pull up his
message.
He was
from a faraway place, was he not?
Was that him?
Yeah, it was. Mick is from the UK. It It mentioned that in his email, which is cool. Yeah, it's from Carnforth, I think is what the place was called. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but that's cool. I mean, that's pretty neat. Yep, Carnforth in the northwest UK.
There he is. Found his message.
Yeah. So, Mick said that...
Can you read it?
Yeah. You want to go ahead?
Sure. He says, I have recently looked into the lighting in my fish room and decided to reduce the brightness both to save in energy use and see what effect it has on the fish. I have tried it out on one rack, and the vision in the tanks has improved as there is less glare and the algae has reduced too. Coincidentally, I'm going to say this wrong. This is you pronounce it. You're the pronouncy guy.
I'll pronounce it in my Italianized way, but pelvica chromis teniatus.
Seem to be happier with the lower lights. I have also listened to the Assassin Snail podcast and have purchased 7 snails with a view to breeding them. I have no substrate in my tanks, but have put a large clump of Java moss in which I hope will act as a nursery for any baby assassins. It would be great to hear your views on the lighting and the Java moss. Best wishes from Carnforth in the northwest UK, Mick.
Okay. Thanks, Mick. Those are some great questions.
I'm going to make a somewhat unrelated but cool-to-me comment. We looked up Carnforth to see what it was, and it's just west of the Yorkshire Dales, which is fun because we love to read the James Herriot books and how he always talks about going up on the Dales. And so I was pointing out on the map to Russ, look, that's where it is!
And that's pretty cool, I think.
Okay. Now I'll return you to your email.
Yes. Well, the first thing we should talk about is the lighting in the fish room. I think reducing the lighting in the fish room to save an energy use is a good idea, of course. Saving energy is good. And it seems like you mentioned your pelvic acromus teniathus seem to be happier with the lower light. Now,
tell us something about those fish. I don't know what those
fish
are. What are those?
They're a close relative of the cribensis. Remember
which
the
we had?
Had some the brightly colored little West African cichlids.
So do they? Where do they come from in the wild that they would like lower light? I mean, do they usually live further down in the water in caves or?
Well, I'm just not entirely sure. I get the impression since they're West African, they're not like Rift Lake cichlids at all.
Okay.
The West African tend to be in softer water and so on, probably in like rainforests, in slow rivers and pools in rainforests and things like that, which would tend to indicate they probably
got
get more
a big
shade.
Canopy over it.
Yeah,
right.
Probably.
So that makes sense.
I'm not an expert on their, you know, biotope they're from, but that's kind of the impression I get from
You're
what
so
I've
modest.
Read about them. So, I would say that it's nice. A lot of fish are just fine in lower light than people need to be able to. I mean, not that people need, but than people like.
To be able to see them well.
To be able to see them well. A lot of times the fish can see just fine in lower light, and sometimes they're happier, especially if you want to breed them or things like that. And I don't think there's any problem with that, as long as the fish seem happy. You know, that's the prime thing, and you're comfortable seeing your fish.
He mentioned there's less glare, so...
Yeah, less glare is good.
Maybe he can even see them better
maybe
now.
Maybe you can even see them better. Some fish actually really pop in terms of their colors, if the lighting is subdued.
Yeah, not literally.
No, not explode. No, fish don't explode, but sometimes their colors actually show up better because they work better on light that's kind of reflected from a distance on their sides.
Mm-hmm.
You see them better, and their colors really show up a little bit better. Some fish are like that. So that might be a factor to consider as well. One thing also that I should mention is that when you have lower light, of course, plants can suffer in that case.
Now, is it a planted tank? Let's see, did he say? I don't think he said.
He didn't say specifically about that one, if it was a planted tank or not. But depending on the type of plant, the plants can suffer. But of course, certain plants will do fine in really low light, including
Java
moss.
If he's just reducing the ambient light in the room, not the light on the tank, is what I had understood he meant. So that might not make a big difference if it was a planted tank.
Well, he's saying he's tried it out on one rack. So what I'm assuming is that he has some sort of lighting, strip lights or something on this rack.
Okay. So it's not just in the room, it's over the tanks.
Right.
Okay.
And he's saying he can see better and so on. So I'm guessing that, and it does depend on the species of fish. You know, there's another thing, too, that fish, if you keep them outdoors and they receive the ultraviolet light from the sun and so on, their colors also really pop. So it depends on the types of fish, it depends on what you're looking for, so on. But, you know, keeping fish outside can really make their colors show and kind of intensify too. So it's a two-edged sword. Depends on where you're going with it, but I think a lot has to do with the type of fish and so on. I don't see any problem with it, at least for these fish that he's trying it with. Now, speaking about lower light plants kind of leads us to the next part of his question with his assassin snails. And be patient with those snails. You remember how long it took us for them to start breeding.
Wasn't it?
Before we noticed any babies, at least, it took a while, but now we have tons of them. Remind me, I need to bring some into the pet store soon, because we've got a lot. But you wanted to breed them, and you said you have no substrate in your tanks, but you put a large clump of Java moss in there as a nursery for any baby assassin snails. Well, I haven't tried breeding assassin snails with no substrate. I get the impression, both from my own observations and things that I have read, that the baby assassin snails spend a lot of time in the substrate soon after hatching.
They do. They kind of burrow down in there. They don't really come out until they're a little bit bigger.
Yeah, you usually don't see them until they're a little bit bigger. So this is an interesting experiment.
How big were they?
When I noticed?
I mean, they stay down there for like a month or two after they hatch, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
Just to avoid getting munched on?
They appear to, at least. I very rarely see ones that are smaller than 1/8 of an inch. And I know they hatch at a much, much smaller size than that, mm-hmm. based on their egg size and so on. So, I get the impression that they hide in the substrate for quite a long time, and that they eat things that live in the detritus and so on there. Now,
would Java moss have the same kind of detritus for them to feast upon?
Only if it's dirty. It would have some microbial life on it. I mean, Java moss mm-hmm. is covered in little microbes, and they might eat that too. I'm not sure. I suspect that they'll probably breed a little better if they have some substrate, like some medium grain gravel with some detritus in there. But it's an interesting experiment to try with the Java moss. You'll probably get some, as long as they're laying eggs. You know, you'll probably get some.
Maybe not quite as many as you would with the gravel.
And it's worth a try. I mean, as kind of an experiment, you could just try it out and see what you get. If you get all kinds of them, then we know. But
maybe in a few months you could let us know how it went.
Yeah, that would be great if you would let us know. But I'm just going to put out my guess that they'll probably breed better with substrate, because they do tend to have some natural proclivities for burrowing in substrate and so on. But, you know, I've never tried it without, so I can't really say.
Okay. Well, shall we finish up with our last question?
Yes.
Today it's from Brandon. He wants to know about piranhas.
Ah, yes. Brandon had two things to say about piranhas, I think. One, he wanted to know what the proper tank setup for his red-bellied piranhas. What type of setup that would be great for them, such as gravel and plants, etc. I just want to make sure that they are comfortable in the best of health.
It's always a good thing for your fish to be.
It is indeed. Well, this is one of those questions where I have to say, I don't know very much.
Those weeks.
Yes, because I've never kept piranhas. They're not something you commonly see in the stores around here. I would have to double check, but I think... I recall
Brandon
well.
Doesn't say where Brandon's
doesn't
from.
Doesn't say where he's from.
Okay, Utah's not real big on piranhas.
No. The only piranha that I've ever seen in a pet store was when I was a child years ago. There was a pet store in our neighborhood, one of my favorites. They had, I believe it was a red-bellied piranha, in a tank by itself. And there was a little sign on it that said, if you pay us 50 cents, we'll throw in a feeder goldfish. There's no guarantee whether it'll eat it or not. I never did. I didn't want to do that. But that's what people did in the store, in that pet store. So I have very limited experience. So that's about the extent of it. So I can't really say a whole lot, although...
We can try and look around and do some research.
Yeah, and if we have any piranha experts listening, please let us know. Please tell us your experiences. I could just say from a general standpoint that I don't know that they really care that much about substrate that I know of. Of course, it matters whether or not you can keep the water quality up. So pick
what
a substrate that allows you
like?
To keep the water quality good. Oh, right now I'm just speaking generally in terms of, you know, if it's easy to keep the substrate clean, that'll help improve the water quality. But they are, you know, tend to be Amazon basin type fish. So I would expect that they'd probably be happiest and most likely to breed in sort of soft acid water. But I'm assuming that most of them do fairly well and adapt to, you know, water with higher alkalinity and so on if the water quality is good. You know, most fish are like that. They won't necessarily breed in their own, in water that's not much like their own habitat, but they will usually adapt to living and being quite comfortable in it. And I would say, you know, you need a large tank for a piranha because piranhas are big and they're carnivorous and they make a lot of a mess. And so they need large quarters, partly to help keep the water quality high. And that's really all I can say, just general things that would apply to any large carnivorous fish. He's also wondering about purchasing a black piranha and wondering where he could purchase some from. Well, I don't know about the local laws in your area about black piranhas. I'm assuming that in your area that they are available. It's not a problem. And that said, they are fairly widely available online. If you go to aquabid.com, they're often available. I saw one recently there for
$75.
I saw a larger one on monsterfishkeepers.com, which is an interesting site if you like bizarre and especially
monster-y
large
kind of
bizarre fish. One was for $550.
Wow.
It was an adult, I think.
How big are black piranhas?
I'm not sure of the exact size, but, you know,
that'd be big
it's
enough.
Not a small fish. Not like a paku or anything. Pakus can get to be 3 feet long, but it's not that big, but quite a bit smaller than that. So they're available at quite a few sites. So those are some that you could look at. You might want to check out Aquabid is a good
start. Make sure of any local ordinances.
That would be important. You don't want it to get it confiscated or anything like that. So we're glad you enjoy the show. We're actually would like to thank everyone for contributing to the show so thoroughly this week. That's lovely.
Good.
We've had, I think, more contributors this week than we have ever, probably, in terms of numbers.
Week.
Yeah, of different contributors.
It's fun. It's fun to hear from you guys during the week and see what you're up to with your fishies.
Right, and from at least three different countries.
Yeah,
I mean,
how cool is that?
Fun. So, thank you. Keep up the good work.
Maybe next week we'll talk about algae crews a little bit, too.
Maybe. We'll see. Maybe we'll be inundated with all sorts of other questions. We'll never know. That would be nice. But have a great week, and we hope you enjoy the richer, clearer sound from this microphone. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.